Hello and welcome to tonight's arena, coming to you live from the Pavilion Theatre in Dúnlaoire. We're here for a very special reason, to celebrate the life and work of Seamus Heaney as his definitive collection is published, called The Poems of Seamus Heaney. The book is made up of nearly 700 poems, his 12 published collections, plus some 200 uncollected poems, works which appeared in publications from parish bulletins and student newspapers to The New Yorker, Vogue and The Irish Times, to name just a handful. But beyond these, there are 25 previously unpublished poems selected by Seamus Heaney's family, who join us here in the audience at the Pavilion tonight. Mary, Catherine, Mick and Christopher, thank you for being here. With me on stage to talk about these works and discoveries are two of the editors of the collection, the poet and academic Bernard O'Donoghue and Dr. Rosie Lavin of Trinity College Dublin. We also have critic and commentator Fintan O'Toole, poets Moya Cannon and Victoria Kennefic, and musicians Neil Martin and Louise Mulcahy are also here. I want to start with Bernard O'Donoghue and Rosie Lavin, who did the hard work of bringing all of this together. Rosie, this began in 2017. Yourself and your fellow editors, Bernard O'Donoghue and Matthew Hollis and the Heaney family. What was the aim when you were starting out on this new book?
Well, I think there was a strong wish after Seamus Heaney died to bring together the body of his work and to try and bring together the extraordinary range and breadth of poems that he published in his lifetime. We worked also closely with colleagues who were editing two sibling volumes, the translations of Seamus Heaney, edited by Marco Sanzogni, published in 2022, and the letters of Seamus Heaney, published in 2023 and edited by Christopher Reed. And so we knew that the poems were going to follow those two extraordinary books. And then, as you said, we had this wonderful task of bringing together Seamus's much-loved 12 collections of poetry, but also the joy of gathering together, as you've said, more than 200 uncollected poems, so poems that were out there in the world in wonderfully diverse magazines, books, newspapers, and then we had the extraordinary gift of the 25 previously unpublished poems from the Heaney family. So our aim was to give a full sense of the diversity and the achievement and the wonder of Seamus Heaney's poetry.
Fintan O'Toole, what's the importance of a book like this, I suppose, is the question I'm asking. There's a lot of detective work has gone into this behind the scenes. What does it add to our knowledge of Seamus Heaney and our understanding of his work?
Well, it's first of all a magnificent piece of work, and you know, I think we're all really, really grateful to Bernard and to Rosie for the labour that's gone into it, the care, the love that's gone into it. The word monumental comes to mind, you know, because it's a big book and it is a monument to one of the great literary achievements of the last century. It gives that achievement the form that it will hold, I think, for another century. You know, this is the book. It gives you what you don't get with the individual volumes, right? Which is, as Rosie was saying, the sense of the flow of Heaney's imagination. So obviously the individual volumes are the culling from this constant outpouring of creativity, of work, of responses to events, to thoughts, to memories. And what you get when you include the fugitive work and then some of the unpublished work is, you know, it's the sense of the stream from which this, you know, great harvest is sort of taken, you know, and it sort of gives you the sense of something constant. I'm trying to write the biography of Seamus Heaney at the moment, you know, and I'm stunned by the degree to which there's something miraculous about the ability to keep open those channels. After all, he was a public person. I mean, almost from, you know, 1966, you know, the publication of his first volume, he was famous Seamus. He was, you know, this figure that was kind of recognized already. And that gathers and gathers, you know, he's teaching, he's celebrated, he's giving lectures, he's writing essays. he's becomes, particularly after the Nobel Prize, you know, becomes this sort of sainted figure, you know, who has to somehow represent the nation. You know, the burden of all of that and the extraordinary grace with which he dealt with that is in a way something that I'm trying to deal with. But you have to remind yourself that while all that's going on, he's keeping open this mysterious capacity, you know, to just keep shaping language, keep shaping words, memories, thoughts. And the what came to mind is just two lines out of District and Circle, which is his translation from a 18th century Gaelic poem by Onor O'Sullivan. And the poem is about, it's a sort of instruction by the poet to the blacksmith making him a spade. But of course, it's about how to write poems. And it's just these two lines really came to mind, which he says, no trace of the hammer to show on the sheen of the blade, the thing to have purchase and spring and be fit for the strain. And I think what we see here is the hammer is events, is violence, is the troubles, is, you know, just the daily life, all of that stuff. And the sheen of the blade is the artistry. And I think what remains miraculous is that we're aware all the time of the resonance of the hammer, you know, of all that pressure. But the sheen of the blade really, really shines out from this volume as something that is miraculous.
Victoria, Digging is the very first poem in the very first collection, Death of a Naturalist. It's his manifesto, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I remember the first time I encountered it, the enormous relief I felt. And it's, I suppose, testament to his brilliance as a poet, obviously, but also what a brilliant teacher he was in his work as well, because he is in this moment looking at his father outside, laboring and digging and thinking about the lineage that he comes from with all of these hardworking men who have conquered the land and worked with it. And here he is in his study writing. And at the time, as a baby poet, I was then, I remember feeling such a shock of recognition at that really uncomfortable reality of being somebody who is slightly different in a particular way to the rest of your family and trying to figure out, is it useful? Is it worth it? Is it okay? And this poem really giving permission to me as a poet who was in training, I suppose, as we always are in training, but also the sense of that there's a lineage in that too. So looking at his father, I think it also inspires Heaney to go back and look at his predecessors and kind of sets the scene for the fact that he is an archaeologist of language and an archaeologist of poetry. And it gives a certain sense of, I suppose, of permission, as I said, for me to not necessarily be good at domestic situations and knowing what to do in certain situations and appreciating so many of my family in the way that they can fall quite easily into doing certain tasks that have been done before them and then being the observer of that. And it's hard to be the observer when the process is invisible, but it's so wonderful about this book that here we have the tangible result of all of that creative labor, and it was labor. And as well as that, that danger, you know, as he describes the gun or the pen sitting like a gun, that sense of him being aware too of going against something and it being dangerous and a risk. So it's a very instructive and brilliant, inspiring poem.
As we're going to do with some of Seamus Heaney's poems this evening, let's hear it. This is Seamus Heaney reading Digging from recordings made by Lannan and RTE to mark his 70th birthday in 2009.
Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug, the shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade. Just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf. Digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
And that, of course, was Seamus Heaney reading Digging. Bernard, you knew Seamus, you're a fellow poet. Were there any surprises along the way while you and Rosie were putting this book together?
Well, I suppose the primary surprise is just the sort of sustaining of the quality through it all. I mean, some poems of Heaney's have become, you know, household words, really, and everybody knows them. But there are a great number of poems that of the same kind of quality, which has slipped into cracks in various ways, really. I mean, because they weren't included in the selected poems, the various editions of the selected poems, for example. So the kind of restoration of them to bring them back out into the light was a wonderful thing, really. I suppose, above all, I feel it's kind of more of the same, you know. I mean, Seamus himself said that there were still some poems that didn't make it into Door Into the Dark, his second book, which I still like, which I feel strongly about still. And I think that happens all the time, you know, because partly the volumes are shaped by their theme. You know, a volume like North, for example, has got, as everybody knows, very kind of clear and definite public presence, you know, which dictates to some extent the kind of poems that get into it and don't get into it. And some of the poems that didn't get into it then appear in Fieldwork, the next book, which is a different kind of book. You know?
To what degree do you think that this is giving us a new encounter with existing work?
I think just size, really. I mean, just the sustaining of the work at a very high level all the way through. There's another thing I think that Seamus's best-known poems are so familiar and so clear in the way they're expressed and in the kind of message that they contain, and in the way that they represent the kind of experience that we all have. You know, he's so good at doing that that it's easy to overlook the kind of difficulty is perhaps too strong a word, but they're serious, highly intelligent, thoughtful poems that are kind of worked through in the different drafts of poems that he made. But also, they're very intellectual poems at the same time as being direct and expressive.
Moya Cannon, I want to bring you in here. You crossed paths with Seamus from time to time. How supportive was he of up-and-coming poets?
I think he was supportive of... he had a wonderful sense of community. I remember the first time I read, actually, in Dublin, I was terribly nervous. My sister-in-law was coming up to play music with me. I said, there'll be nobody there. And it was a reading in Bewley's, and he turned up and, of course, was suitably chuffed. And and that was sort of maybe 94, I think. But even at that stage, before the Nobel Prize, he sort of came in a side door because he was sort of afraid of being mobbed on the way in. I think he had the countryman's sense of the importance of community, which is also something terribly, terribly important in literature.
Rosie, we asked you to choose a favourite poem. It's not an easy question, given that you've assembled 700 poems pretty much in this. But one of the poems that you came back to us was An Artist, about the painter Cézanne from Station Island. Why does that mean so much to you?
I think it means so much to me because it's always interesting to see how writers or artists talk about other writers and artists who inspired them. And that's what Heaney does in this poem, An Artist. So he doesn't name Cézanne in the poem. And quite strikingly, the poem begins with the line, I love the thought of his anger. And I think, as Bernard was saying, you know, there are some maybe aspects of Heaney's work and of things that get expressed in the poems, which we sometimes don't see that clearly because we know the other aspects so well. But I think, you know, the fact that he latched on to this idea of Cézanne as a kind of stubborn, brave artist who was not going to bow to try and win the to try and win the taste or approval of others, the fact that he gives us a vision of Cézanne as somebody absolutely committed to his work, you know, almost as committed as the kind of stubborn hardness of the green apples that Cézanne was painting in his still lives, I think is absolutely wonderful. And it kind of reflects, in a sense, and Victoria used the word labour, I think quite rightly, it reflects the hard work and dedication that is behind all of these poems, and which he did express in his writing in various ways, and so I think it's quite extraordinary to see him responding to that in the work not of another writer but of a visual artist. And he did have a great sense of visual art, and of course many friendships with painters. So I love the poem, and I think the poem's fascinating for those reasons.
Okay, let's hear it. This is Seamus Heaney reading An Artist.
I love the thought of his anger, his obstinacy against the rock, his coercion of the substance from green apples. The way he was a dog barking at the image of himself barking, and his hatred of his own embrace of working as the only thing that worked, the vulgarity of expecting ever gratitude or admiration, which would mean a stealing from him. The way his fortitude held and hardened because he did what he knew. His forehead like a hurled bull, travelling unpainted space, behind the apple and behind the mountain.
Fintan O'Toole, his poetry is central to the Irish canon, but also he's a touchstone internationally as well. We should never underestimate that.
Very much so, you know, and this, I mean, he was published, of course, in London, very early. I mean, London was hugely important to him. You know, we have to keep that in mind, you know, that he would later on make it very clear, you know, that he was an Irish poet and he didn't want to be included in the Penguin Book of British Verse and all that. But, you know, the cosmopolitanism of London was always there for him and was always vital to him. He was always in communion with English poets, both historically and living. You know, Ted Hughes, for example, was a, you know, absolutely key figure for him. Hughes was as important to him as he is to, you know, to younger Irish poets. You know, so he was always kind of in that sort of mainstream of English language literature, but not English literature. You know what I mean? And he then, I think, you know, particularly in the 80s and the 90s and after the Nobel Prize, He's very conscious of the fact that, you know, that he is an international figure, and that there's a certain kind of obligation that he feels. He had already felt great obligation to Ireland and to the Irish situation, and there's now an obligation somehow to kind of live up to being the Nobel Prize-winning poet and to respond. And he's always torn then about, you know, he doesn't want to be making political speeches. He doesn't want to be sounding off about whatever the latest thing is. And so what's remarkable, I think, is his ability to navigate that kind of international fame, to be this kind of figure for everybody, to, again, you know, show this incredible grace, and at the same time to kind of keep his privacy. And he never writes propaganda. I mean, it's really interesting to see there are a couple of poems in the unpublished poems which are kind of propagandistic, you know, and understandably so. Like there's a Bloody Sunday poem, for example, that he wrote to be sung by Luke Kelly in 1972. Well, they're actually quite rare. You know, he's very careful about processing his own anger as a citizen into art, you know, to beat it out in that way, to hammer it out so that it becomes something different. But at the same time, he never runs away entirely. You know, he's always kind of moving between this commitment and his own freedom, and is always beating himself up over whether he's got the right balance between those two things.
We'll come back to our panel shortly, but I'm delighted to be joined now by musician and composer Neil Martin, who often shared a stage with Seamus Heaney. Neil, you're going to play Port Nabucco. What did that tune mean to Seamus?
Seamus first heard that tune, I believe, when Marianne himself visited Sean O'Rada in the late 1960s in Coolay in West Cork, and O'Rada played the piece on the piano, and so moved was Seamus by it. O'Rada explained as well the lore behind it about the Port Nabucco, the song of the spirits from Inishvik Alan, and so moved was Seamus with that, that he wrote the given note off the back of that.
Thanks to Neil Martin. We'll be back with more from the Pavilion Theatre after the break. You are listening to Thursday Night's Arena, coming to you live from the Pavilion in Dunlira, where we're celebrating the life and work of Seamus Heaney. Moya, keeping going means a lot to you from the Spirit Level collection. It's your favourite Heaney poem. It's a tribute to Seamus's brother Hugh, but maybe talk to us about what else is going on in that poem.
Yeah, I first heard this in Galway at a reading many years ago, and I just happened to bump into Seamus Heaney afterwards, and he's so approachable, and I said that was a wonderful, wonderful reading, and I said particularly keeping going, and he said that's one my heart's in, and I can understand it because it was still, you know, when the troubles were really going on, it was a tribute to his brother Hugh, who was farming up in Ballaghy, and also to all those people who were living through the Troubles, and the kind of people who were trying to keep the very fragile links open between communities at very difficult times. It's a big, baggy, awkward sort of a poem, but a really magnificent one, full of sort of shifts and juxtapositions, you know. It starts off with this sort of childhood sort of scenario, which he's so good at conjuring up, his brother going around with a chair on his shoulder, pretending to be play bagpipes, you know. And he's for a sparring, he has a whitewash brush. Then he goes into the whitewashing and how it just absolutely transforms a house every spring, and everything's this whole new world people are woken to. And then he goes on a bit to, you know, what he describes elsewhere as the den life, just the community, the family living so close together, and then moves outside. He said it was all hill fort, clay, etc., and the earthiness of it. And then he moves into something much more sinister, into the absolute darkness of the darkness is in his own culture. And, you know, sort of he said, you know, when he read Macbeth, it was familiar, actually. Just the absolute, you know, sort of people stirring evil, really. And then he goes on to talk about an absolutely dreadful, dreadful murder. A young RUC reservist who's waiting, a young tradesman waiting for his lift. And he's waiting one morning and a car comes up and he's shot in the face. And then he goes back and he says, oh yeah, he's talked about this tar border along the base of the house, this dark reeking border, and it's the border between the two communities. And then he talks about the young man falling and his copious blood sort of flowing past this tar border. And then in the last marvelous stanza, he talks about my dear brother, and he speaks, you know, in a way that perhaps is quite theatrical, actually, which brothers mightn't talk to one another in a tone which they mightn't normally talk to one another. He says, "You've good courage," you know, and he describes how he drives with his big tractor into the town nearby, and he waves at people. He says, "You keep the old roads open by driving on the new ones," and you wave. And then he talks about, you know, how tough it must be. And sometimes when he's in the byre, you know, he has as we used to call a turn. And he says, you know, and you said, but then you look up and you see the whitewash brush, and you keep going, you know, this hanging in terrible times. And it's a wonderful tribute to the people who held it together.
I want to ask you as well about Sunlight. It's another one of your favourite of his poems from 1975's North.
Yeah.
We're going to listen to it shortly, but before that, maybe put it in context for us. It's dedicated to his Aunt Mary?
It's dedicated to his Aunt Mary. It's like a painting. And, you know, when I'm reading it, one of his most well-known statements is about Kavanagh. You know, he said that Kavanagh, he said his work allowed him to dwell without cultural anxiety among the usual landmarks of his life. And it's so evident in this particular poem where he describes, it's like a rustic Vermeer. He's describing his wonderful aunt, who was part of the, as so many unmarried women were, part of the economy and part of the household in country areas, and really honours it speaks with enormous affection. And, you know, the imagery that he uses, sort of, he talks about the sun like a griddle, you know, the pump, like the helmeted pump. And he talks about her measled shins. And then he talks about love, you know, in a most extraordinary final. I think he might have been quite a favourite because in another poem he talks about him, or bringing him on an outing, a spoiled pet, you know, in something or other, you know. He might have been a favourite.
Let's listen to Seamus Heaney reading Sunlight.
There was a sunlit absence. The helmeted pump in the yard heated its iron. Water honeyed in the slung bucket. And the sun stood like a griddle cooling against the wall of each long afternoon. So her hand scuffled over the bakeboard. The reddening stove sent its plaque of heat against her, where she stood in a flowery apron by the window. Now she dusts the board with a goose's wing, now sits broad-lapped with whitened nails and measling shins. Here is a space again, the scone rising to the tick of two clocks. And here is love, like a tinsmith scoop, sunk past its gleam in the meal bin.
Bernard, we've just been talking about North. Fieldwork is the collection that comes straight after that. It's another significant moment for Seamus Heaney. We find him returning to a more lyrical voice.
Yes, I mean, and that's what he said himself. I mean, there's a kind of release and liberation in going to this kind of softer, gentler voice rather than the public, responsible voice that Moya and everyone has talked about. But it's a wonderfully complex volume, Fieldwork, I think, because it has the beautiful, extremely lyrical, summary Glanmore sonnets, but you can see what he means in those, in poems like that, with the movement towards a, a softer voice. But it also, of course, has two of his very greatest and most upsetting elegies, really, the great poem Casualty, you know, about Louis O'Neill, who was blown up in a pub because he went to the pub on a night when there was an IRA embargo on it after Bloody Sunday, and he was killed there. And that's a poem that's been compared to Yeats's Easter 1916 in the way that it focuses in an extraordinarily important historical moment. And the other one, of course, the other great elegy is The Strand at Loch Beg for his second cousin, Colin McCartney, who was killed going back from a football match in Dublin. A simple sectarian killing by Loch Beg. Near home, and wonderful evocations of home again, which he does so well, you know. And it's wonderful, just going back from the match, you know, you're nearly home, you know, and then suddenly this unlikely kind of roadblock starts with swinging lanterns, all the rest of it, you know. And the reader, of course, gradually gets the message, really. So it is a very, very mixed volume, I think.
Fintan O'Toole, a poem you wanted to talk about is Postscript, and we're going to hear it shortly. Why does it mean so much to you, and indeed to a lot of people? It's one of his favourites.
It is indeed. I happen to be lucky enough to live a lot of my time very close to the Flaggy Shore in County Clare, which is where it's set. And it sort of makes you think differently about a poem when you know the landscape. You know, I've walked it 100 times, you know. And so the first thing it really comes home to, you know, is just the photographic skill he has of evoking place, you know, and it's remarkable. It's exact, you know, not just in terms of the physical nature of the place, but also the atmosphere of it, the wind and the light, you know, and all that kind of going on in it. And the Flaggy Shore is quite a small strip of land jutting out into Galway Bay. It has this, well, it's two things that come out in the poem, right? One is that at the beginning of the Flaggy Shore is a big house called Mount Vernon, which was Lady Gregory's summer house. Yeats spent a lot of time there. Yeats, Lady Gregory, that whole history comes into the poem through swans. You know, Yeats's famous swans at Coole Park kind of reappear, as it were, in a little lake, which is on one side of the Flaggy Shore. So you have that kind of whole history of the Irish Renaissance and going back to all of that, very beautifully and subtly evoked. But then it goes back to what Moya was talking about in Keeping Going, the border. So this strip of land, which, by the way, if you read it carefully, he doesn't even get out of the bloody car, you know, which is very Seamus. Like he's dry. He says, useless to think you can park and, you know, get out. He's just driving through it with Brian Friel and Brian Friel's wife and Mary in the car. And they just drive through it. But it becomes in this poem a different kind of borderland. So it's you've got the lake and the swans on one side, you've got the sea on the other side. And it's this place becomes nowhere and everywhere. And so it builds to this extraordinary image of you are neither here nor there, a hurry through which known and strange things pass as big soft buffetings come against the car and catch the heart off guard and blow it open. So the border becomes, instead of this horror, becomes this place of sort of infinite radiance.
As lovely as your reading of that line was, Fintan, I think we're going to hear Seamus now read the script. This is from his collection, The Spirit Level.
And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the Flaggy Shore in September or October when the wind and the light are working off each other, so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland among stones, the surface of a slate-grey lake is lit by the earth-lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown, headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park and capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there. A hurry through which known and strange things pass, as big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open.
Now let's have a second piece of music from Neil Martin. You might recognise this. This is Planxty Erwin. Thank you, Neil Martin. We will be back after these. You're listening to Arena on this Thursday night in October, coming to you live from the Pavilion in Dúnlaoire to mark the publication of the poems of Seamus Heaney. With me on stage, two of the editors of the collection, the poet and academic Bernard O'Donoghue and Rosie Lavin of Trinity College Dublin. Fintan O'Toole is here, and the poets Moya Cannon and Victoria Kennefic. Victoria, I want to go back again to Death of a Naturalist, because along with Digging, Midterm Break is probably one of the first poems that most of us encountered or read at school. There's a reason, though, that so many of us probably still know those poems by heart.
Absolutely. I think it's an extraordinary collection of poems, Death of a Naturalist. Iconic, I think, especially among poets who are preparing their own first collections for publication. And that poem, I think, is probably the first, along with maybe Early Purges and Blackberry Picking, that we all encountered in school, and is entirely memorable because of it is so beautifully and extraordinarily and tenderly written, but also its devastation and its tragedy. And what's extraordinary, I think, about Heaney as a poet, among many other things, is that he never, ever forgets what it is like to be a child and what he was like as a child. And that's an incredible act of bravery and authenticity, to be able to bring us back then to our childhoods, and indeed to speak to children as we were when we encountered this poem for the first time. And I remember it so clearly. I think I was maybe in fourth class, and the shock of this enormous loss and the way he describes it with such grace. And not only that, but how he acknowledges too his parents' grief. And I think that is just indicative of his generosity in terms of what he observes as a poet, because you believe it is not adult Seamus Heaney looking back and seeing his parents, but him actually seeing them differently for the first time and losing that innocence in believing them to be, you know, impenetrable in terms of life's vagaries. And it is a profound coming of age moment. And I think one that lingers with us. And I always get this feeling with Heaney that it's almost like for every stage of your life, there is a poem. And it's like he holds your hand in word and in intention, but always giving you space to move around the poem as you need to yourself.
Vincent, we've been considering Heaney's earliest published works. You've had time to take in the uncollected poems in this volume. What sort of context do they give to the existing collections?
I would say there's two things in particular. One is to remind us that he can be very funny. So you don't get a lot of humour in the main collections. You know, he's very aware in a sense of the sort of the burden that's on him, you know, and there is a kind of profound seriousness to his work, as well as the sort of lyrical beauty and the emotion in it. But the occasional poems, particularly, I think the things that you get, which, because he was always firing things off to people, he was faxing off things to people for their birthdays or whatever. There's an extraordinary, I mean, it's absolutely amazing performance, you know, which is a commencement address in Fordham University in New York, and it's an absolute tour de force. I mean, anybody given a commencement address is usually cliches, and it's kind of awkward and embarrassing, and he does it in verse, you know. And it's really funny, it's really brilliant, and it just has a whole other side of him, you know, that kind of imagination that's always kind of there. And you kind of realise that there's a certain cost to being Seamus Heaney, which is he suppresses this side of himself in the public Seamus Heaney, I think, quite a bit. I think the other thing that's sort of there all the time, you know, is you know, this hauntedness, you know, that particularly as he gets older, I think one of the things that's so moving about all those later poems, you know, is that this is someone who's continually in touch with the dead, you know. Victoria was just talking about, you know, this very early poem, which is about death and the dead, you know. And it never goes away, and it sort of deepens over time. And you find this both in the published poems, but also in those sort of later poems where he's so aware of his own mortality. And they're extraordinarily moving to read, I think. You know, it's hard not to read them knowing that, you know, he was going to die in far too young in 2013. But there is a sense of sort of coming to terms with that, that runs both, I think, through those later unpublished poems and through some of the published ones. And I think it's one of the things that's so important about him. It's one of the reasons why people read him, right? Which is that he's writing through a period when we're losing religion. You know, in Ireland and elsewhere, the world is being disenchanted from religion. And one of the reasons why people in Ireland and everywhere else come back to Heaney is that he gives us what religion gives you, which is that continual dialogue with all the people who've gone before us. Heaney's always in an afterlife as well as being in this life.
Dr. Rosie Lavin, I want to bring you back in here. The book is huge in its scope. It spans poetry from the undergrad years at Queen's to, as Fintan was talking about, the very last works in 2013. What was it like to see the early work and then to see where Seamus Heaney went with it after that?
Well, I think there is a kind of a long relationship between consistency and development and change in his work. So, and one of the things that I think is most interestingly consistent, and it's right there in those early poems for magazines at Queen's University Belfast, that he signed Incertus, the Latin for, you know, uncertain, is a willingness and an almost a kind of sort of a kind of drive to question poetry and to question himself as a poet, to question the usefulness, the appropriateness of poetry at certain times, and certainly, you know, once the troubles start, and he's mindful of his position and his responsibilities, but also his desires as a writer, you know, in the midst of appalling conflict. So that sense of questioning himself and questioning his art never leaves him, and I think that's actually an incredibly reassuring thing somehow, and it kind of reaffirms the value and the achievement of the poems. But there is also a kind of steadiness, which I think we see all the more now that we see the presence of the uncollected poems between the collections, and Fintan gave the great example of The Road to Derry, that Bloody Sunday poem, which he does write in 1972, but didn't publish until 1997, the 25th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. So there are those roads deliberately not taken, and yet things that were important enough to commit to poetry for one reason or another. But I think still bringing them into dialogue with the 12 volumes does give us that sense of the kind of steadiness, the commitment to the poetry, even though he was ready to question it. And just to go back to his love for that artist Cézanne we were talking about, he talked about Cézanne's pictures being so steady in themselves, they steady you and the world, and you in the world. And I think there is something about that for all of us in reading Seamus's poems as well.
Just quite briefly, you've been working on this since 2017. How has this changed your understanding of Seamus Heaney's work, or has it?
It certainly has. I mean, I think partly because working, one of the things that Bernard and I and our colleague Matthew Hollis and co-editor have done is had the opportunity to look at drafts of the work to really see how complex and detailed his process of drafting poems was before they were published, but even after they were published, one of the things we do in the notes for the book is track the changes that he made. You know, a poem that might have been published in the Irish Times and then in an American magazine and then finally gets published in one of the collections. He goes back to that poem before it finally appears, you know, in book form. And I think so being able to follow his thought processes almost and see how the poems themselves evolve, even once they're in print, has just been fascinating and remarkable.
Bernard, the book ends with the poem Those Winter Evenings. Moya is going to read it for us in a moment. Would you like to tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. Doing the work for this book has been, everybody will understand, has been the most extraordinary honour and privilege. And we've been so grateful every day for having this to do. And, of course, a major part of that is the incomparable support of the Heaney family, who are famous for it. But at the very beginning of it, in 2017, when I was first looking at it, I was in touch with Mary, and Mary said, "Do you know the poem called Those Winter Evenings?" I said, "No, I've never heard of it, I've never seen it." So she sent it to me at the very beginning of the process, and it's now the last poem in the book, and it is a wonderful poem about Seamus and Mary, and one of my favourite possessions, of course, because I still have the book, the letter filed away.
So now Moya Cannon is going to read for us Those Winter Evenings.
Those winter evenings. Those winter evenings we walked the strand, watching lights of planes coming in above Howth Head, sailing down the dark, beginning their descent high in the east, each on the same flight path, at staggered intervals. It was like that dream of a kite flyer, the string taut in his hand and the lift palpable, but the kite itself invisible to him, a heavy weight drag upwards through the mist roof, yet in the breast, a kind of settlement, as on those winter evenings when we walked and watched for lights of planes.
We're joined on stage now by the piper Louise Mulcahy, who is going to play us out. Before that, I want to thank you, our audience, for being here with us tonight. My guests, Bernard O'Donoghue, Rosie Lavin, Fintan O'Toole, Moya Cannon, Victoria Kennefic, and Neil Martin. I'd also really like to thank the staff of the Pavilion Theatre here today for their hard work. Tonight's broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, our engineers Patter Carney, Liam Mullen, and Tommy O'Sullivan. And tonight's show was researched by Paula Shields and produced by Sinead Egan. Louise, you're going to play us out with a set of reels now. Tell us a little bit about them, and it's on a set of pipes that used to belong to Liam O'Flynn.
That's right, Rick. Well, it's a real honour to be here as part of this magnificent celebration, and I was thrilled to receive a copy of this fabulous publication. And I'd like to reference one particular poem, Cayley on the Deck, and in honour of that, in honour of the celebration here this evening, County Clare was also referenced earlier this evening by Fintan and Postscript. Seamus also references County Clare within this poem, and also two tune types from the Irish tradition, Irish traditional music, jigs and reels, and he also mentions hornpipes. So I thought, in honour of that connection and inspired by that poem, I would play three tunes for you this evening. The first one, I'd like to honour that wonderful work and celebrated connection and music and poetry with the iconic piper Liam O'Flynn and the wonderful work of Seamus Heaney. The first tune features in the Liam O'Flynn collection. It was an original composition of Liam's, and it's called The March of the Clans. And the other two tunes reference County Clare. The first one is a tune which is called The Humours of Carrigaholt. So again, drawing on that connection with Postscript and Cayley on the Deck. And the last one was recorded and played by Liam O'Flynn on stage with Seamus Heaney in the Barbican in London in 1999 and broadcast on RTE Radio 1. The set of pipes I'm playing are a beautiful flat set of pipes. I'm honoured to have them. They were played by Liam during his career and recorded on some tracks with Seamus Heaney. And I'm delighted to have these pipes on loan from in Peebriel in Dublin.
Ladies and gentlemen, Louise Mulcahy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.